Good afternoon and welcome to this encore edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Today, we're going to listen to a conversation I had in the fall of 2024 with the acclaimed novelist Elizabeth Strout. In 2009, she won the Pulitzer Prize for her wonderful novel about a famously cantankerous and compelling character, Olive Kittredge. That iconic novel has sold more than 1 million copies, and it made the New York Times list of the best 100 books of the 21st century. In 2013, in The Burgess Boys, Strout told the story of two brothers, Jim and Bob, lawyers whose lives unfold in very different ways. It was chosen as a best book of the year by The Washington Post, NPR, and Good Housekeeping. In 2016, Elizabeth Strout won the Malapart Prize for My Name is Lucy Barton, the book that introduced one of Strout's most memorable and beloved characters, who has since resurfaced in 4 subsequent books, including Anything is Possible from 2018. That collection of interwoven stories garnered the Story Prize. Her 2022 book, O. William, was shortlisted for the Booker Prize. It chronicles the relationship of Lucy and her ex-husband, who seek safety in Maine during the pandemic. And with her latest book, published in September of 2024, Elizabeth Strout brings all of these characters together in Tell Me Everything, a quiet, masterful, beautiful peroration on love and loyalty. Elizabeth Strout joined me on Zoom from New York. Liz, welcome back. It's always great to have you.
Hi, Tom. It's lovely to see you and to be here again. Thank you so much for having me.
So I've had the great pleasure of talking to you about several of your books. This one is an absolute beautiful masterpiece. Congratulations and thank you. It's really just a wonderful read, and the experience of reading it is just a wonderful thing. Talk about the impulse to collect all of these characters that you've told us about and introduced us to in previous books in this new one, Tell Me Everything.
Well, it was funny because, you know, I had been thinking a lot about Bob Burgess just because I like him so much. And I was thinking, I'd like to sort of write a book about Bob. And then it sounds silly, but it kind of occurred to me that at this point, a lot of them are all living up there, you know, within 45 minutes of each other. And many of them are right there in Crosby. And I realized, oh my goodness, there's a chance to get Olive and Lucy in the same room, which just tickled my fancy. So, in that way, I just thought, well, let's go for it and see what happens.
Because you have revisited some of these characters previously. I mean, you wrote a second book, Olive Again, about Olive Kittredge. As I mentioned, Lucy, you know, keeps popping up in all sorts of books, either sometimes as the central character or as certainly a person that's, you know, close to the action. There was a Broadway engagement of a show about Lucy Barton. There was a wonderful Emmy Award-winning HBO series about Olive Kittredge. So you have these film treatments, stage treatments, but of course the only treatments that really matter are the ones in your head. what attracts you to Bob Burgess? What attracts you to Lucy Barton?
Well, you know, honestly, can I just say that I never intended to rewrite any of these characters. Never did I see my career as one that manifested itself in you know, what they call now this universe. I just didn't see it that way. But with Olive, you know, she came back to me with full force. I thought, okay, I've got to pay attention to you because you're Olive. So I wrote Olive again. And then with Lucy, I thought that she was done. And then I wrote, oh, let's think about her husband. He'll have his story. And then the pandemic. So I never intended to continue to go back to these people, but they've been very real to me over the years. And I've always just loved Bob. He's just so Bob.
He is so Bob. He and his brother are both lawyers. His brother's a big, high-powered New York Manhattan attorney. Bob chose a much quieter, simpler life, but he still deals with some complicated and interesting cases, as he does in this book, Tell Me Everything. And if you haven't read any of your other books, which is a thought I don't even want to consider, that there are people who haven't done that. But if you haven't read any of these other books, you still do get to know these folks. And this is a real trick. You've done this in all the books where you've reintroduced people. You don't have to have the backstory.
I've always written every book as though it was the first one that a reader would read.
So. Yeah, yeah. And that's not easy. I mean, because you know so much, and you know that many of your readers are going to know so much. You've got to figure out how to edit your way through that. Yeah.
Right, exactly. A lot of not what to say.
Yeah, not what to say, right. Olive, you know, who's just been a compelling character for such a long time, is now 90 years old. She's in an assisted living facility in Crosby, Maine. And by the way, correction, in the introduction today, I mentioned Shirley Falls as the nexus of this. It's actually Crosby, Maine, which is your fictional town. I got the name wrong. I got the wrong name of the fictional town.
Shirley Falls is 45 minutes away and stuff happens there as well.
Yeah, stuff happens there as well. How did you find coming to how Olive has changed? How did you approach how she has, you know, evolved as any of us would if we make it to 90 years old?
Right. Well, you know, I just thought, okay, just be Olive, continue to be Olive, and she's mellowed a tiny, tiny bit. As she did in Olive Again, she was getting ready to become a little tiny bit more mellow, but, you know, she's still Olive. She's just Olive.
She is indeed. Olive meets Lucy. Lucy comes and visits her regularly, and they trade stories, and they talk about unrecorded lives. Where does your mind go when you ponder this notion of lives unrecorded?
You know, I honestly think that it's probably the reason that I am a writer, because from my earliest memory, I can just remember seeing people, you know, walking down the street and thinking, but who are you? Like, what does your house look like? What are you thinking as you're walking down that street? And just understanding that so many people I would never know. And, you know, many people most of us have unrecorded lives. And I find that so interesting. And I sort of wanted to honor that in a way, because I think that many people, you know, we're quite brave, really, when you think about it, in our unrecorded lives. We just keep going and living and trying our best, most of us.
And that word recorded or unrecorded is an interesting term given our present circumstances, because there's so many people who record, for my way of thinking, much too much of their lives.
Right,
and
exactly.
They post it, you know, on social media.
But is that really their life?
Right. And that, yeah, exactly.
That's what I'm interested in, is like what's really going on in your head, actually, you know, not just the pictures on Facebook, but.
But it is a basic human impulse to be noticed, to be.
Yes, we want to be seen. We want to be heard.
And that's sometimes difficult to do. It's difficult to be seen. It's difficult to be heard. It's easy to be overwhelmed.
Yeah. And people don't listen as much as they should, which is why Bob and Lucy develop a very special friendship, because they really do listen. And Olive listens. And, you know, that's part of the connection, is really listening and talking freely.
Because Olive and Lucy, they trade stories just back and forth. I mean, she comes and visits regularly. And why does Olive want to share stories with Lucy in particular?
Well, because she's been thinking about it, and she knows that Lucy Barton lives in town, and she's has one particular story that she starts off with, and she's just been thinking about it, and she sort of thinks that maybe, you know, like many people do, maybe if she could talk to a fiction writer about it, it could be used, because, you know, Olive wants to be seen. But anyway, so she summons Lucy through Bob Burgess, and she says, come on over, Lucy, I'd like to talk to you. And that's the first time they get together.
And can you read the section that Olive and Lucy get together for that first time? That's really a wonderful scene.
Okay.
Again, Olive is 90 years old in this assisted living place.
Fine.
Lucy is a famous writer who's living in Crosby, Maine, because she sort of fled there during the pandemic and sort of never went back to New York full time.
Exactly. Just two pages. That's also, everybody can relax. Don't worry. So on this particular autumn day, the yellow leaves of the tree seen through Olive's large windowed back doorway were quivering to the ground as she waited for Lucy Barton to show up. Olive, sitting in her wingback chair, saw two chickadees and a titmouse at her feeder. She leaned forward and spotted a squirrel. Olive rapped her knuckles against the window hard, and the squirrel scurried away. "Huh," said Olive, sitting back. She hated squirrels. They ate her flowers, and they were always bothering her birds. Olive found her glasses on the small table next to her and picked up her big cordless phone, which was also on the table, and pressed some numbers on it. "Isabel," said Olive, "I can't come visit you this morning. I'm having a visitor. I'll tell you about it when I come see you this afternoon. Bye now." Olive clicked the phone off and looked around her small apartment. She tried to imagine the place through the writer's eyes, and Olive decided it was all right. It was neat and not cluttered with hideous knickknacks the way so many old people had in their homes, tabletops crowded with photographs of their grandchildren, such foolishness. Olive had four grandchildren, but she only had a photograph of one of them in her bedroom, a small photo of little Henry, who was not so little anymore. And in the living room, on her hutch, she kept a large photograph of her first husband, Henry, and that was enough. She looked at it now and said, "Well, Henry, we'll see if she's responsive." At 5 minutes before 10, there was a light knock on her door that faced the hallway, and Olive yelled out, "Come in!" In stepped a small woman who looked meek and mousy. Olive could not stand meek and mousy looking people. The woman said, "I'm sorry I'm early. I'm always early. I can't seem to help it." "That's fine. I hate people who are late. Sit down," Olive said, and she nodded toward the small couch across the wall from her. Lucy Barton came in and sat down. She was wearing a blue and black plaid coat that went to her knees and jeans that Olive thought were too tight for a woman her age. Lucy was 66. Olive had looked it up. The sofa was a stiff one. Olive knew this, but the woman somehow, the way she sat on it, made it appear even stiffer, and she had the strangest things on her feet, boots with long, big silver zippers right up the front of them. Olive could see the small ankles and the tight pants that were tucked into them. "Take your coat off," Olive said. "No, thank you. I get cold easily." Olive rolled her eyes. "I would hardly say it's cold in here." Olive was disappointed in this creature. A silence fell into the room, and Olive let it sit there. Finally, Lucy Barton said, "Well, it's nice to meet you." "Aunt," was all Olive said, swinging one foot back and forth. There was something odd about this woman. She wore no glasses, and her eyes were not small, but she had a slightly stunned look on her face. "What are those things you've got on your feet?" Olive asked. The woman looked down at them, sticking her toes straight up. "Oh, they're boots. We went to Rockland last summer, and I found these in a store." Rockland, money. "Of course," Olive said, thought. She said, "There's no snow on the ground. Don't know why you need boots." The woman closed her eyes for a long moment, and when she opened them, she did not look at Olive. "So I hear you're with us in town to stay," Olive said. "Who told you that?" The woman asked this as though really curious to know, and she continued to look slightly bewildered. "Bob Burgess," and then the woman's face changed. It became gentle, relaxed for a moment. "Right," she said.
Olive Kittredge, indeed. Olive is Olive. She has not changed in some fundamental ways. That's Elizabeth Strout, the best-selling author, reading from her newest novel. It's a gem. It's called Tell Me Everything. So, Liz, forgive me if I brought this up before, but it's a quote from an interview I did years ago with E.L. Doctorow that has really stuck with me about stories and about the importance of stories. And Doctorow told me that stories project life as something of moral consequence, that without stories, we don't have a moral framework with which to exist in the world. So it's this proposal that life is morally consequential, and stories are so important, and stories are very, very important to this book. They are the center of Olive and Lucy's relationship.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. They are. It's stories.
And when you conjured these stories that Olive and Lucy tell each other, or conjured the conversations that Bob and Lucy have on their many walks, and they started walking together, you know, in previous books. This isn't a new thing. You know, were you conscious of, you know, each of these stories, each of these scenes having a point, having a moral? How did you approach writing those?
It's interesting because when I got Lucy and Olive together, you know, for their stories, I mostly just would write out a story and sort of scratch it together and then refine it. And then I began to realize that every story they were telling was somehow tangentially related to the entire book. And I thought, oh, that's great. And I think that was an unconscious thing, because so much of what I do when I'm creating is unconscious. But then I have to come up for air and I have to become conscious. And I realized, oh, that's actually good, because they're all slightly related to the whole concept of the book.
Elizabeth Strout, her new novel is Tell Me Everything. We'll have more with Elizabeth Strout, and we'll talk more about it on the other side of a quick break. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back to this archive edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We're listening to a conversation I had with the acclaimed novelist Elizabeth Strout. We spoke in the fall of 2024 about a wonderful book centered in a small town in Maine that brings together wonderful characters from previous books. It's called Tell Me Everything. If you've read some or all of Elizabeth Strout's earlier books, you'll be delighted to catch up with characters like Olive Kittredge, Lucy Barton, and Bob Burgess. But if you haven't encountered them in the past, not to worry. Tell Me Everything is a terrific standalone novel. Our conversation was pre-recorded, so we can't take any calls or online comments today. Here's more of my conversation with Elizabeth Strout. So, Liz, you don't shy away from the big questions of life in this book, or in any of your books, really. At what point you have Lucy asking on one of their walks with Bob, what is the point of anyone's life? And I read that and I thought, gosh, I'm glad she's answering it and not me, because it's just really hard to ponder that. Provoked in me this internal journey of thinking, does there have to be a point,
Exactly.
And if there is, how do you even identify it? I mean, it's a really, people have been thinking about this for,
yeah.
centuries.
Forever.
we're no closer than we ever were, are we?
No, not a bit. But poor little Lucy puts it out there.
So, I mean, did you feel any obligation as the omniscient author to have her be able to answer that, or to have Bob or her scene partner answer it?
I mean, I just thought Lucy's going to ask that, because Lucy is in her way childlike, and she's just going to ask that, and it provokes a certain response from Bob, and but there's no neat answer to that, we all know.
So when someone says, what's the point of anyone's life, is that the same as saying, what is the meaning of our lives?
Yeah, I think probably. I guess so, yeah.
I mean, the whole notion of the meaning of life,
Right.
The point of life, the purpose. But I found myself thinking that there is a distinction between certainly purpose in life and maybe the meaning of life. I mean,
the point of it,
I have a purpose with this show, and I have a purpose being the father of my daughter, and I have a purpose being the husband of my wife, but I'm not sure what any of that means.
Well, I know. Think about it and then put it away.
Yeah, put it away. So but you ain't telling, huh? Is that it? Because at one point, Bob's wife, who is a raised Catholic and has become a Unitarian minister, she says, we like to think of our lives as being within our control, but they may not be completely so. And of course, all of us have had that. I think all of therapy is based on, what you can control and what you can't,
Exactly.
Are the thoughts and actions and behavior of these characters in your control? I mean, they are, because you're making them up, but do you have a sense of, lack of control even as to how they're going to progress?
Yes, I do, because you're right. They are in my control because I am making them up. I am perfectly aware that they are all figments of my imagination. So let's just put that out there right now. I know that I made these people up. That said, they are characters and they have to stay true to their character, which doesn't mean they can't surprise me. And they do, which is a good thing because if they don't surprise me, they're not going to surprise the reader. But that even their surprises have to be within their character. Do you see what I mean?
Can you give me an example of how one of the characters surprised you, where you take a turn with that person that really you didn't expect to be taking, a week before you wrote it or a month before you wrote
Well,
it?
yeah, I mean, I kept thinking, especially about Bob and Lucy. And as I kept writing those scenes, I thought, oh, what is going to happen? I mean, I really did not know what was going to happen to those two characters. And then I finally realized that Bob is Bob, and that's what's going to happen is Bob will be Bob. And there we are with that. And then the very final scene just came to me, just literally as I was writing it. And I thought, oh, okay, there we go.
Wow, so that was that wasn't the kind of thing that you had figured out the ending before you
No,
started the beginning.
not at all. Not
Yeah,
at all.
yeah.
No.
Elizabeth Strout, the book is called "Tell Me Everything." When it comes to control, and the control you've had in your life, I mean, you were a lawyer for a little while before you became a writer full time. Do you think that progression in your life? I mean, I was a musician before I became a talk show host. We've tried different things, you and me. And did you have a sense that your destiny as a writer was to a certain extent out of your control? Was it an inevitable thing?
I feel that it was. I mean, I always felt that I was a writer, and I went to law school because nobody was interested in my writing. But and for many years, I was only a lawyer for 6 months, and then that went away, thank goodness. But the point is that for many years, I thought that the whole law school thing had been just a really wrong turn in the road, but it wasn't. It helped me as a writer, and it took me years to understand that because when you read legal cases, the first three or four paragraphs just tell you the story of what happened. And those would be my favorite paragraphs because they were so concise, just stating the facts. And then years and years later, I realized I think that helped me. I think that helped strip away all that extra feeling that I always had and made me more concise. So
More
I'm not sure.
concise, because
Yeah.
one doesn't necessarily associate being concise with legal writing. That's
Right.
interesting.
Well, the rest of that legal writing was was legal writing. But the first few paragraphs in every case just stated the case that we were reading about.
Here's
Just
what
stated.
happened. Yeah.
Walking down the street, car hits you, the sun was at a certain angle, blah, blah, and that's it. Boom.
Yeah. Because your writing in this book and in many of your books is very direct. It's I hate to call it simple, but
Oh, yeah.
it's not peopled with huge words I have to look up every 2 pages. It's direct, and that's on purpose too. And is that because of the way the characters are or the way you are?
I think that's the way my voice, my writer's voice developed. I think I just began to finally, I think at the very beginning of my career, which was when I was really quite young, I think I kept trying to write like a writer. And then I finally realized, no, just say it. Just say it in your own voice. Just say it. And so that's what I do.
And there's a quietness to this book,
Yeah.
a tone. You're in Crosby, Maine, or in Shirley Falls, Maine. They're not big metropolises. There's not a lot of people. There's not a lot of stuff going on. It's beautiful. It's cold. It's sunny. It's all of those things, but maintaining that quiet tone, I found to be a great advantage of being able to read the book, because you could really envelop yourself in some calmness,
Right.
which is very, antithetical to how the rest of our lives are led.
Right. Or even how their lives are led. But I discovered that through the use of this particular narrator. This is a different kind of narrator than I've had in the past. This is a very, very large narrator who can see everything and yet at the same time swoops down to include the reader almost directly. So the reader is quietly placed every time, you know, there's a change. The narrator is going with the reader and saying, it's okay, you know, we're here, don't worry. I mean, not saying that, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, and I guess I'm not a lit crit person, you know. I wasn't an English major. Is it third person omniscient? I mean, this is,
yeah, it is, but it was just a different style of that for me.
Yeah, you know? Because at one point the narrator is describing Bob's ex-wife who is struggling mm-hmm. with alcohol. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene in which she's, you know, sneaking some booze into her apartment in New York. And the narrator says, oh, Pam, oh, poor Pam, with an exclamation point. And then it says, seriously, you should feel sorry for her. So it's, talk about direct, you know.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that
is literally telling you this story.
Yeah. And it's interesting. You and I have talked before about the fact that you're also a musician, you're a pianist, and you play the piano regularly. Music is one of the fundamental dimensions of music is the tension between tension and release. You know, the great composers know how to build up, you know, and pull the wire as tight as it can be, and then release the wire so that it floods out and relaxes. Do you ever think, when it comes to this quietude of the tone, that you're going to need to, you know, ratchet up the tension in the way it's narrated, and then have a release?
I do try and think. Again, it's not that conscious, but I do try and provide the reader's ear all the time. You know, the words are going to fall on the reader's ear in a certain way. And I'm very conscious of that. You know, if it's been a little too quiet, then I'll have, you know, some noise on the page, but not for very long. And then, you know, back to scenery, you know, whatever I feel the reader needs to get through the book with, you know, easily.
And that's really interesting to get through the book easily. So you don't want the reader working and having to think too much about what this means and what this, where this is going.
I just want them to be able to receive it. That's my job for the reader. Just, you know, if you can receive this, that will be great.
And you have to receive it in an uncluttered way. I mean, without judgment. Yeah.
That's right. Precisely. And, you know, and that's why I learned years ago, you know, if I show off, that's a false sentence. If I try and do something a little fancy, that's false, you know, for me. So I'm just going to be very quietly direct with the reader.
Yeah, so that authenticity is really important. Because there's also authority. You need the authority of being the writer who does really, in fact, know what's going on inside all these people's heads.
I think authority is a very important thing for the writer.
And do you find yourself writing scenes that you rewrite because you think, oh, wait a minute, this doesn't have enough authority or it doesn't have enough authenticity?
It does. Yes, I rewrite constantly. I mean, I'll write a sentence and I'll rewrite it. And, you know, and I'm always looking for that authority and also what I call the heartbeat. You know, if there's not a heartbeat in the scene, then it gets on the floor because there has to be something living in that scene, you know.
That's fascinating. Now, how do you detect a heartbeat? How do you create a heartbeat, a rhythm almost?
You know, this is something I learned years and years ago when I only had maybe, you know, an hour or two every other day to work on my writing because I was teaching, I was raising my daughter, you know, whatever. And I began to realize that if I was, you know, for example, if I was trying to get Isabel Goodrow out of the grocery store, that was an idiotic thing to do. I would spend an hour getting her out of the grocery store and I realized, oh, just leave her there, forget it. Do a space and then move on. And that was very helpful for me. So I began to understand that if I could write a scene during this hour or two that I had every day, and if the scene had a heartbeat, then that would be a good thing. So that's when I began to write in scenes. And I realized that the heartbeat came from Well, I have a theory that at any given time, there's always something that we're thinking of more than other, you know, more in it could be just dreading the root canal that we have tomorrow, or it could be worrying if our spouse is having an affair, you know, it could be anything, small or large. And I realized that if I could take whatever was clutching at my chest a tiny bit and transpose it, not factually, but the feeling of that, if I could transpose that feeling into a character, then it might have a heartbeat. So that's what I've been doing.
And that takes a particular kind of ear, doesn't it?
I mean, you really have to be thinking about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's really, it's wonderful, because there is a heartbeat on every page of this book.
I'm so glad. And
there really is. And I wouldn't have described it as a heartbeat. I'm really delighted that you've put in.
That's what I came up with years ago.
Yeah. with a name for it. you mentioned Isabel Goodrow, who is one of Olive's friends, right?
Yeah.
They're in assisted living place together. They're best friends. And at one point, Isabel makes plans to leave and to go to another place with her kids and stuff. The narrator writes, it was like waiting for a death. This is from the point of view of Olive. She simply wanted Isabel gone now, although she did not want Isabel gone at all. Olive was crestfallen that her friend was going to leave.
Yeah.
And it gets worked out eventually. But it struck me that problems like this with friends don't dissipate just because you're 90 years old.
These are
two junior high girls, you know.
Exactly. If anything, it gets more intense, because at that point in their lives, they are really each other's main person.
They talk to each other every day.
Every day.
Calling each other all the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
And friendship and relationships, marriages, you write, as often is the case, those of us who need love so badly at a particular moment can be off-putting to those who want to love us and those who do love us. This love thing is complicated. We've known that for a few centuries.
Very complicated. we have indeed.
But it's this notion of being off-putting to those who want to love us. And Olive is a really great character to think about that, you know, through her prism, because she's so crabby and cantankerous.
She's loving.
But she's loving. I mean,
she is. She does have love in her heart. She really does. And she is also loved
by a lot of people and a whole lot of readers. As a matter of fact, the book is Tell Me Everything. The author is my guest, Elizabeth Strout. We'll have more with Elizabeth Strout after a quick break. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us today on this encore edition of Midday, we're listening to a conversation I had in the fall of 2024 with one of my favorite authors, Elizabeth Strout. She won the Pulitzer Prize for her iconic masterpiece, Olive Kittredge, which sold more than 1 million copies and earned 7 Emmy Awards as an HBO series. Olive Kittredge is one of several wonderful characters who reappear in Elizabeth Strout's latest novel, Tell Me Everything. If you've read some of Strout's previous work, books like The Burgess Boys or O. William or Lucy by the Sea, you'll recognize several other characters in this terrific book. Lucy Barton makes her 5th appearance in a Strout novel since being introduced back in 2016 in the gripping fictional memoir, My Name is Lucy Barton. And if Tell Me Everything is your first encounter with this generous and compassionate author, my guess is that you'll become just as attached to Strout's marvelous creations as her legions of longtime readers are. Tell Me Everything is a book that doesn't shy away from life's big questions, which are explored through the prism of good-hearted people who are kind, complicated, and compelling. Elizabeth Strout joined me on Zoom because our conversation was pre-recorded. We aren't able to take any new calls or online comments today. So, Liz, I wonder if I could ask you to read another passage. This is a passage that begins on page 194, and it has to do with love and the role that how well we know somebody plays in these relationships. It's a fascinating scene with Lucy and Bob.
Right. So they've gone for their walk on the river, and they're sitting there for a moment. And Lucy stared straight out at the river for a long time. And then she said, "Bob, I think that we were all standing on shifting sand." She did not look at him as she spoke. "I mean, we don't ever really know another person. And so we make them up according to when they came into our lives. And if you're young, as many people are when they marry, you have no idea who that person really is. And so you live with them for years. You have a house together, kids together." She stopped and said, "Sorry." "No, no, go on," Bob said. "But even if you marry someone later in life, no one knows who another person is. And that is terrifying. You know how you said you were terrified? As far as I'm concerned, everyone should be. I mean, every so often a couple has a fight and things get said and it scares them both profoundly. And yet in a heartbeat, they pretend that night fight never happened because they can't proceed with what they just learned. And I understand that. I do." Lucy nodded, still looking at the river. "What I'm trying to say, Bob, is that people just live their lives with no real knowledge of anybody. Like that woman who emailed me this morning and might be filled with envy, but I don't know if she is," Lucy said, looking at him now. "My point is that every person on this earth is so complicated. Bob, we're all so complicated, and we match up for a moment or maybe a lifetime with somebody because we feel that we're connected to them, and we are. But we're not in a certain way because nobody can go into the crevices of another's mind. Even the person can't go into the crevices of their own mind. And we live, all of us, as though we can. And I respect that, Bob. I do."
Yeah, she says we should all be terrified that we can't really know somebody else. Have you thought a lot about that, about what this notion of knowing somebody means even?
Yes, you know, I think about, I realize that much of my work is revolving around this. I mean, as I sort of look back and I understand, you know, this is a sort of a theme I've had for a long time, that we're all pretty unknowable in a certain kind of way. I don't find that terrifying, you know, Lucy does at that moment, but I find it intriguing, you see, because we do know each other and yet we don't.
I think it was Gabriel Garcia Marquez maybe who made the comment that everybody has three lives, the public life, the private life, and the secret life. And as a novelist, you've got to decide how much of the secret part to dollop out.
Yeah, exactly. That's really interesting. Yeah.
But knowing someone, I know this as a musician, you know, and I thought, right, do I know this piece? You know, I mean, even pieces I've conducted millions of times, you know, do I really know it? You know, what does knowing it mean?
Something more to know.
Yeah. And what does knowing my wife mean? What does knowing my daughter mean? What does knowing my friends need?
Exactly. Yeah. What does knowing yourself mean?
Yeah. And Bob struggles with this too. At one point, you know, you say Bob had very little sense of who he was, which is true for many of us, but this was especially true for Bob.
Right.
And he is involved in a court case, a legal case, that seems quite terrible at the outset. And then he ushers this guy through, you know, a legal dilemma. So that's a backdrop of the story of all of these people. But I wonder, you know, since you're making them all up, all these people, is there a healthy dollop of confusion about each one of them that you need to make sure you maintain? Do you ever get nervous that you're gonna know too much since they're all in your mind?
That's an interesting question. I think the answer is no. I think I know enough about them to present them to the reader. And probably I know a little bit more than the reader, but I don't think the reader needs to know everything. That's an interesting question. I don't feel particularly confused by them.
Let's go to the phones. We have Robin on the line from Baltimore. Welcome to the show with Elizabeth Strout.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Elizabeth. I'm a little bit mad at Tom because he knows that this is Robin Weiss. I consider myself your biggest fan in the universe. I've read every single one of your books, and I just happened to turn on the radio and hear you, so I'm really happy for this coincidence. But my question has to do with listening. I'm a psychiatrist, but that's not the only reason. I've just always felt that listening was crucial, and it's silly that I've married someone who has ADD, and he's not really a great listener. But anyhow, I'm curious about where you develop your obvious reverence for listening that comes through in all your books, but particularly in this one, because it's so crucial to the relationship between your characters, your two main characters in this book.
Right. Well, first of all, thank you so much for your nice remarks about my work. Thank you. But, you know, listening, I grew up without many people around, and both the towns that I lived in, we lived far outside of the town. So I really did not see that many people as a very young child. And I wanted to. I was fascinated by people from my earliest memory, maybe because I just didn't see that many. But ever since I can remember, I have listened and listened and listened. And just to sit in a restaurant and, you know, sort of, I mean, well, I guess it's just eavesdropping, but just to listen to everybody. And then as I get older, I have realized that how well we listen in our relationships is crucial, because many of us don't listen that well. And that was what I was trying to sort of get at a little bit in this book, is like, we need to be heard, because if we're heard, then we can be seen. If that makes sense.
Yeah. And one does follow the other with any luck. But it's, you know, it doesn't always follow the other, I suppose. And that can be difficult as well. But this notion that we all need to be heard, and then maybe even stretch it further, not just heard, but understood.
Yes.
Which is, you know, even more complicated. That's getting greedy. Perhaps we shouldn't.
That's getting greedy.
We have an email from Susan, and thank you for that call, Robin. I appreciate it. Susan in Mount Washington says, I love Elizabeth's books. Her characters are so nuanced and quirky and absolutely real to me. I believe that fiction improves our empathy because it lets us inside someone else's head for a while. I can't wait to read this new book. People have talked about you, Liz, as a very empathetic writer, an empathetic approach to each of these characters. Is that something that's purposeful?
You know, it's something that I sort of began to realize as my career went ahead. And I think what happens is that way back, I understood that when I go to the page, excuse me, I suspend a judgment. I'm not judgmental to my characters. And in real life, I'm probably just as judgy as everybody else, because I think almost, you know, to a certain extent, we probably have to be to maneuver our way through life. But one of the most freeing things for me is when I go to the page, I just am not judging them.
Yeah, and being without judgment is a hard trick to pull off in life or even in fiction. It's an impulse for all of us to judge, you know, to say, oh, that's wrong, that's right, that's confusing, that's clear, whatever. It's interesting, you know, you have been judged, your writing has been judged, literally judged by all these people in all these contests. At the top of the show, I sort of did a little walking tour of all of the prizes you've won. You won the Pulitzer Prize, which is kind of the big kahuna in American literature, back in 2009. That was a long time ago. It was for Olive Kittredge. It was well-deserved. But I wonder, you know, having had that kind of recognition, that kind of accolade at a relatively early stage of your career. I mean, you weren't a brand new writer, but it was 15 years ago, and you've written a bunch of books since. What has that meant to you, and what do you think, what role, if any, has it played in informing you as a writer?
Well, I'm very glad I won it. There's no downside for it about that to me. But I was older because I had been working at my writing for years. And then when I finally did win that, I was in my 50s. And I think that was helpful because I think if you win it when you're really young, it can maybe knock you off your socks a little bit. But excuse me, I'm just having a little throat thing. But it worried me for about 5 minutes because I thought, oh my goodness, I'm going to have so many more readers. But then I understood that I had always held myself to my highest level of writing that I possibly could, and that wasn't going to change. And so I just didn't worry about it.
And as you think about future projects, are you thinking more about, reincorporating, reappearing some of these people that have become so beloved? And as you say, you got a lot of readers, so there really are a lot of people in your audience who are gonna know something about many of the people that are introduced in this book, certainly. As
Yeah.
you think ahead, you're thinking about continuing that, indulging that impulse?
Well, no, I have no. Let me just say, working on an entirely different character and an entirely different setting. So, but I don't dare say ever no because, I've said that my whole life and I just kept doing it. But I will say this, that Olive Kittredge will never die on my watch.
Ah, she won't die. Well, that's good to know, actually. I'm glad.
Oh.
I'm glad. That's some breaking news that
Yeah,
I can
here we are.
take to
That's
bed tonight with a
okay.
smile on my face.
Yeah, I
That's
just
good.
realized. Nope, she's not.
Is it easier, on book number 10 than it was on book number 2 or 3? It was a Thomas Mann or somebody who said a writer is something is someone for whom writing is very difficult. Your books don't take 7 or 8 years in between to appear. It's more like 2 or 3 years at the most. Is the exercise, the endeavor of writing for you harder or easier or the same as it was when you started?
I think it's gotten easier. I think that for many, many years, like I said, I was trying to struggle to find my voice. And I do feel that I've been training for a marathon for years and years and years, and that now I'm running it.
Ah, only now you're running it.
Yeah.
And how new is that sensation?
And that was, it's been pretty new for the last 5 or 6 years. I thought, okay, now I'm running the marathon.
And you're in the middle of
Well, I don't
it.
know. I don't know actually about that, but I have felt that I was running the marathon.
I mean, does the you and I are both in our 60s, late 60s. Do we automatically assume that we're going to be a little smarter now than we were when we started in our 30s and 40s? Do you make that assumption about yourself?
Boy, that's a good question. I think I can only say I'm glad I'm not young again. I mean, there's problems with getting older, but I'm glad I'm not young again because I just, I really didn't know
You know
everything.
more, that's for sure.
Yeah, I
Elizabeth Stroud, her new novel is beautiful. It's called Tell Me Everything. Liz, thank you so much. It's always
do.
a pleasure.
It's lovely to talk to you. Thank you so much.
This has been an encore edition of Midday. In the fall of 2024, I spoke with the best-selling author and winner of the Pulitzer Prize, Elizabeth Stroud. She talked about her latest novel, Tell Me Everything. That's it for us today. Thanks for listening to Midday on the radio and online. We hope you'll subscribe to our podcast and that you'll check out all your favorite WYPR shows on the WYPR app. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.